This is the stroking of the Mahiroa Koatu, the healing stone.
It's about Maori instruments, the various forms of Maori instruments and the process of rediscovering them.
She has dedicated a life to sonically mapping the world's rivers.
Ancient musicians are known to have taken inspiration from natural sounds. Accordingly, these natural sounds and the voices the instruments are able to produce have been important in the revival process.
Listening to the river today, I don't know what it is, but I can sort of hear it singing to me. And all those other years, it was just water flowing down the river to me. But it's a spiritual being now.
The natural sounds of this landscape, this is the landscape of the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand. So to work with the sounds of the bush and the sound of a particular river, the Arahura, there, along with Richard and the instruments he's playing in this piece, was a wonderful opportunity.
My interest in stone, and a particular two stones, one is Pakoi, the other is the Ponamu, that gives me conditional access to the world of Ponamu, to the world of the Arahura River itself.
Richard Nuns is a musician who developed a goal which became completely compelling, and it's a goal associated with how the two communities in New Zealand, the Maori community and the non-Maori or Pākehā community, interact. This goal was to give voices back, I think he might put it, give back the voices of the indigenous instruments, which had been suppressed, the playing of which and the instruments themselves basically had been suppressed by missionary action in the 19th century. Perhaps that may have happened to Native American instruments here, or almost happened, perhaps. It happened comprehensively in New Zealand. I mean, the instruments were collected. They were stashed in the British Museum, stashed in New Zealand museums. Nobody knew what they sounded like. I've always hated seeing museum, instruments in museums in which you can't hear what they sound like. They're sort of in a coma, I always think of them as being.
This is a Mere Ponamu, a jade club. The first sequence is stroking the surface of the club with a stone.
And the traditions of how to play them were almost gone. And in some case of some instruments, they'd really gone. So Richard got together with a Maori musician, a very important Maori musician in New Zealand, Hirini Melbourne, who they shared similar vision. And together with Clem Mellish, who's a carver who works in jade and stone and so on, they began to replicate the instruments. They would be able to get permission to take them out of their glass cases and try to play them. And they started exploring just how they might be played.
Haukirunga. Haukiwaho. Hau ki roto i a hau.
And then they would go around the various Maori communities, meeting with the elders and trying to see if there were any residual memories of how the instruments had been played and what the context was. And it became clear that most of the instruments were not entertainment, for entertainment and purpose. Many of them were probably designed to evoke natural sounds, environmental sounds, which is another strong reason why I wanted to merge those two layers in the piece. Most recently, after I'd finished the piece, Richard and his other collaborators believe they've discovered that the instruments were primarily played by women, which was a nice discovery. So what drew me to Richard is this passion and this generosity, this generous passion of his, and the beauty of the sounds he makes. The instruments are intimate, and he makes them, gives them that quality when he plays them.
The water gone down any since yesterday?
Yeah.
You think it has?
Yeah,
it might
have.
You all gone? Yeah. E wā metal, ko pau tini rangatira, tēnā koe, tēnā korua. Kua tai mai nei ki te awatapu, kei te kimihia, te tiro, ngā paunamu, ngā taonga o mātou tūpuna I tēnei ata. He he nōre, he garorea, ki te atua, he mangarongo, ki te whenua, he kāro whai, ki ngā tangata katoa. Hanga e te atua, he nā kauhau, he roto ki tēnā o mātou, kakatungi e tā waru o tapu, āke āke, āmene. My name's Tilly Tainui and I'm sitting here at the side of the Arahura River with Richard Nuns and Matthew Leonard.
This river's name, Arahura, the Pathway of Hura, may sound familiar to the many travellers who've sailed on the New Zealand Inter-Island Ferry named after it. Te Waipounamu, the relatively recent name given to the South Island, is commonly translated as Waters of Greenstone. Pounamu is Māori for the rare South Island jade so valued for jewellery and ornaments in the indigenous craft tradition and the souvenir market. The oral traditions and archaeology of the South Island's recognised traditional owners, Ngāi Tahu, provides evidence of a pre-colonial economy which used Pounamu as a currency, the trade generating a network of trails which cut through the tangled forests of the wild west coast. In the 21st century, a treaty and an oral culture still protects and governs access and ownership, although this hasn't prevented some recent spectacular cases of theft.
For years and years, I used to go up the river with my sisters and their husbands, and I was just bored to tears because I couldn't find a pounamu and I couldn't be bothered looking for them. Then the Arahura came into Picton and I went up to take part in the karanga. What I was calling to the waka Arahura, something come over me. Must have been the wairua or the spiritual being or something. But the feeling for Painamu, it just flowed through my body, and I came home and I couldn't keep off the awa. And from then on, I've been coming up and finding heaps and heaps of Painamu. And this happened in, I would say, about 84. It was the first time I started to look for Painamu after that. Now I'm here today with Richard, and I found three. And I've given two to Matthew and one to Richard.
Now aged in her late 60s, Tilly Tainui lives in what was once a railway settlement between the west coast towns of Greymouth and Hokitika. Walk down the road a bit, and you're looking out at the Tasman Sea. Tilly's role as kaitiaki, or guardian of the river, is a combination of resource manager, spiritual guide and storyteller for the traditions of Waiwai, a group with their own distinct identity amongst South Island Māori. It's the time of torrential flooding after heavy rains that are the most fertile for prospecting for Painamu, as the jade is driven out of its hiding places at altitude.
Listening to the river today, I don't know what it is, but I can sort of hear it singing to me. And all those other years, it was just water flowing down the river to me. But it's a spiritual being now. It's got a new meaning, the awa. Seems every time I come to it, it has a different meaning.
One thing you learn after 2 days wading in the icy water with Tilly, musician Richard Nuns, and a pack of recording equipment is that what you think looks like Painamu rarely is. Before we set out, Richard perched himself on a couch in Tilly's cottage, tenderly unwrapping his mokopuna, or children, members of a whānau, or family of instruments in stone. All the instruments have their own individual container, either a flax basket, a PVC tube, or a silk scarf. They're a contradiction, simultaneously fragile and indestructible. Each one has a whakapapa, a genealogy, and as he unwraps them, Richard relates their story, the provenance of their raw material, their performance life, their symbolism, and their individual names.
This is an instrument known as a porotiti. In this instance, it is made from wood, but I am using it in this archival recording because in a month or two, Clem Mellish will have created one of exact proportions to this from the Painamu, from the jade.
Seven of these instruments are made from the Painamu of the Arahura itself and shaped by Nun's longtime collaborator, Ngāpuhi craftsman Clem Mellish. Tilly invites me to inspect the numerous other pieces of Painamu displayed in her home, and there's one in a window seat the size of a lawnmower. The friendship between Tilly Tainui and Richard Nuns began around 1988. Conversations between the two friends are peppered with Māori words and aphorisms, although Tilly isn't altogether fluent in Māori because she grew up in the particular era of New Zealand education when speaking te reo in the classroom earned you strokes of the cane. Richard picks up on their story at the time he was invited to run a workshop on Māori instrument making at the Technical College in Greymouth, or as it's known by in its Māori form, Te Māwhara.
Towards the end of the day, a group of older women who had been there all day had moved closer and closer as I was, during the day as they do, just sort of sidle up by stealth. But they were sitting there sanding their instruments and so on, and then this voice sort of rose out of the group, and I really couldn't tell who it was, and I know she doesn't mind me kind of slightly imitating her accent, but it was, "What you doing tomorrow, dear?" And I said, "Oh, packing up, and we've got to get back over the hill. There's lecturing and classes and the various commitments over there." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "We thought you might like to walk on the river." And, of course, that is very coded for an extraordinary experience that subsequently took place, which is to walk with their ancestor, with their mother, which of course is the Arahura River, which is, along with one or two other rivers, but it's probably the main source of the float stones of jade, the nephrite, the ponamu that comes down. And the invitation was too wonderful to turn down, so in fact we duly met at the river just by the bridge, Road Rail Bridge, and gathered with, there'll be 10 or 12 of the old people from the locality she had gathered together. And of course going on to the river is accompanied by karakia, accompanied by hymns, a whole kind of gradation of moving on to the river with care and respect. And it became very obvious very quickly that my role in all of this was in fact to have brought instruments and to play at various designated areas. And that was fine, and we would walk, and these old people who have spent their lifetime seeing what can't be seen, which is the jade that hides under its oxide and its mother's milk, and they set off, and Tilly particularly with Polaroid glasses on, sunglasses like a heat-seeking missile, just, and won't walk with anybody. There's no multitasking on the river, and she just goes. She tells you to go and sit down there or stay over there or whatever, and she's gone, and she circles. But however, on this day, and it was a very beautiful West Coast day, as they can be, just dazzlingly, dazzlingly bright, we'd walked for maybe 600, 700, 800 metres, maybe a kilometre, and came to a large pool that they were very keen for me to play at, and I duly and subsequently did play for some time.
Richard and I were walking side by side up the hour, and he was playing his kawawa, and we looked down into the river, and there was this beautiful ponamu, and now Richard called it the Heringer. That was the name of the school that I was attending.
And I could hear them becoming animated and excited over. And then when I opened my eyes, what they had seen was a fish, an ika, swim into the pool, which was very... The Arahura is a large, rushing, mountain-fed, snow-fed river, and there are very few still pools, and this was one. And what they had seen was this fish that had swum into the pool, which, of course, the duality is that it was also a hand-sized piece of jade, of ponamu. And they beckoned me in to wade in and bring it out, and then said, "Oh, my homie, give it to me. I keep playing because it changes colour as you play." And that piece almost always travels with me internationally. It's been named, and as I finish any presentation, I tell that story and hand it out.
There's many legends about the ponamu, but this one is about our chief from down here, Poaching. He went up to North Island, and all of the chiefs was there, and in the morning he got up to go down to the river to have his wash, and he looked and he could see this, woman there. The next morning he went down again and she was still there, and she was so beautiful he just lusted after her and he wanted her. So the next morning he got up and he went down and she was there and he stole her. And they made their way down from the North Island all the way down to Arahura here, but first off, her husband, Tamahua, he got up in the morning and he missed Waitaki. So he got his chief and the teko teko, and he came in search of her. And he came all the way down, everywhere that they'd camped, the embers of the fire were still warm, and he knew she was here in the river, so he swam up the river. Poaching knew he was getting closer. If he couldn't have her, Tamahua wasn't going to have her either. So he turned her to ponamu.
Pūrere rā te pūrere hua. Te wāra wā ki rungāra Pipiara ngā hau e whā Ruiara te rongo pai Ruia te pai Marire hau Ruiara.
What did they see as the function of the performances that they'd asked you to do on that day?
It was really just to play to their mother. It was, I'm sure that it was a kind of gift that they had arranged for their mother to listen to and to hear. And, of course, now subsequently I go back with a large number or a significant body of instruments and let them speak to their mother. And, of course, they have a saying there that you never take Ponamu back to the river because you will lose it. So I very carefully build walled pools so there's no way the stone can escape, but that sits in there and talks to the mother.
But is it important for you? Because the time that we spent together, I saw you do that. You'd bundle them up and place them in a secure little eddy pool that you'd blockaded in there. Was it important for the water of the Arahura to flow back over?
Yes, I think so. I think it's kind of in a fanciful, if you like, but it's a way in which the locals understand, or the ones I work with anyway, understand, and it's my understanding that they are talking to their mother. And of course the story of the Ponamu is by and large that the greenstone woman Waitaiki, in one of the main versions, was placed up there by Potini in a fit of pique and anger. And they say, to cut a long story short, they say that when there are floods and storms, she gives birth to her children, which are the float stones that come down the river, which is a most wonderful story. And so they say she is up there still.
Now, another time I received a letter from Mr. Richard Nunns, Esquire, with the measurements of a square piece of Ponamu he wanted to make a kawawa. So I went up the river. I walked for a couple of hours and I never found a Ponamu. I was ready to give up and come home. And as I was coming along, I seen this piece sitting on a stone, and I looked down at it and I said, "What sort of a bloody stone are you? If this is it, that's it." And I brought it home and gave it to Richard. And it just looked like grey wacky. But once the instruments were made, the Ponamu was just beautiful. And my sister, Lady Mason, named it Te Uru, Nauri or Waitaiki, the children of Waitaiki Ponamu.
I've had an extraordinary ongoing relationship with her, and I've often gone to and without guilt asked her to find me a piece of stone for a particular purpose, or to in fact find stone in the knowledge that I pass it on. And in fact beautiful stone has gone around the world in Tilly's name, and I act as a kind of as an agent for that, and also direct significant or people I feel would benefit from meeting with her, or if they're in the area or on the journey, I'm able to make those kind of links as well. And she is this, the stone is her, she is the stone, that kind of adage that you hear amongst many indigenous. It's mana of a people, and they struggle with that because kaitahu have the overall legal governance of the stone now, and in my humble estimation, the people at the Arahura seem to be cut out of any major dealings with the stone, which I think is reprehensible and outrageous. But Tilly is unusual insofar as she moves out into the world. She has an extraordinary way of remaining open in a life of immense highs and lows and some enormous tragedy and continuing tragedy amongst the wider family of Te Hokitika and Arahura. it's not an easy life, and in many ways it's a life that works to a seasonal timetable of jade, of ponamu, of whitebait, of yinunga. It's the old ways, and sadly, of course, benefit checks.
The piece got sparked by a lovely quote from a book called Taonga Puroa. It's about Māori instruments, the various forms of Māori instruments and the process of rediscovering them. In the book, I came across a quote which really sparked things for me. Ancient musicians are known to have taken inspiration from natural sounds. Accordingly, these natural sounds and the voices the instruments are able to produce have been important in the revival process. Well, the concept that music evolved from natural sounds is an old concept, and I'm very familiar with it. But the natural sounds of this landscape, this is the landscape of the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand, which is a very rugged coast. I grew up on the east coast and would go over to the west coast as a child. Rivers are extremely fast and relatively short. I mean, the mountains basically tumble into the sea on the west coast, and sometimes you have no more than about 5 miles between the base of a mountain and the ocean. It's rough, wonderful, rough country. So the sounds of that environment are very precious to me. They really evoke the place where I learned to love sound, essentially, I think, when I was a child. And so to work with the sounds of the bush and the sound of a particular river, the Arahura, there, along with Richard and the instruments he's going to be playing in this piece, was a wonderful opportunity.
These next two instruments are Nauri or Waitaiki, is their collective name. They're the pair of instruments that were made from the piece of stone that Tilly talks about in her story, and that I had the dream about, a piece of stone that metamorphosed into two musical instruments. And the first of these is a nuru. It's a small nuru, a small rounded bent instrument. And is, of course, played like a flute. Second of the pair of instruments made from the one piece of stone is a karangamanu, a traditional bird lure. And in what I play are fragments of calls from about 3, 4, 5 native birds. The pipiwhirao, the korimako, fragments of tui, all native birds.
Sometimes your context is a concert hall or recital room, but it seems to me that your practice is very much bound around environment and of revoicing, giving those instruments, those taonga, the voice in landscape, in the world, in the environment.
Mm. one philosophizes and ponders, as most musicians have, about origins of sound, about influences, about resonances, about significance. And I think a very easy case to posit is in fact that the pūru, the taonga pūru, the traditional instruments of the Māori are in fact the voices of the land itself. It's only a very small jump between the voice of the mother itself, Papatūānuku, and the voices of those taonga. And then there are the other children that give you a roadmap, give you a template, and those are the birds, the insects, the natural forces themselves. I suppose one doesn't have to go and move very far to be confronting those always and choosing to do so. I'm forever playing on rivers and in landscape areas. In fact, a lot of our work, about 60-70% of our work at that time, wasn't too orthodoxly to people at all, but to burial caves, to singing trees, to sea caves that boomed, tidal bores, and also to sacred sites themselves. So we were forever being taken in a very privileged way to sacred sites that most people are unaware of, and of course some dreadful things have been happening to them in terms of sonic vandalism and destruction of these sites that have special significance, and particularly the sonic ones, so that they have no voice anymore, they don't sing.
But it's that ecological subtext, I guess. Yeah. It's a broad sense of ecology. And of sonic ecology as well, which is something that clearly Anea Lockwood is engaged with.
And for a great deal longer than myself, and probably with a much clearer head. I just do it.
We spent time in the recordings that we managed to gather over a couple of days with this whānau of instruments that are offspring of the river. Mm. Is that kind of underlying this project, this compositional collaboration, performance collaboration as well?
There seem to be some wonderful, God, I hate the word, serendipitous connections and resonances. I, for a whole lot of reasons, wanted to work with Anea. She's an unsung hero of New Zealand music. She's chosen to live away for 50 years or more in New York, so it's not any wonder that she's not well known. She also remains, as a senior composer, iconoclastic and an avant-garde in every which way you want to turn it. She's still doing that stuff. But also she has dedicated a life to sonically mapping the world's rivers. So that's one strut. My interest in stone, and a particular stone, or two stones, one is Pākoi, the argillite from our area, the other is the Pounamu, and the Arahuda River, and all that gives me a privileged, although conditional, access to the world of Pounamu, to the world of Waiwai, to the world of the Arahuda River itself. So those all fell in a wonderful way, and the piece just seemed the obvious thing to do.
The soundscape is not only the field recordings. Its primary focus is the river and Tili Tainui, but those are not the only sound materials I work with. I also included Porotiti, which is a bull roarer, and I believe I transposed its pitch down a little bit, but it was already a very deep sound. I wanted to offset the mid-high frequency emphasis of the river sounds with some real bass sound. And that instrument has a great presence.
E wātoki me te kōpau tini rangatira. Tēnā koe, tēnā korua. Tū tai mai nei ki te awatapu, kei te kimihia, te tiro, ngā paunamu, ngā taonga o mātā tūpuna i tēnei ata. I he nōre he gororea, ki te atua, he manga rungo ki te whenua, he kāro whai ki ngā tangata katoa. Hanga e te atua, he nā kauhau, i roto ki tēnā ki tēnā o mātā, kakatungi e tā wāru o tapu, āke āke, āmene.
I brought in a couple of descending whoo sounds, which Richard had made at the end of some demonstration recordings he sent me, playing flutes or playing a kawawao. He does this lovely descending sort of out-breath glissando. So I zipped that across from one speaker to the other a couple of times. And then the porititi comes back at the end, and there's a little section of noru, which is a small four-hole flute, which he plays as a nose flute. There's something nice about that instrument as a nose flute. When they started to explore, and he started to experiment with it as a nose flute, he wasn't at all sure that that was the way it should be played. But he played it at one point to an older Maori woman who, when she heard him playing it as a nose flute as opposed to mouth flute, just began to cry and said, oh, yes, that's the way it really should be, and it's a spiritual communication when it sounds like that.
To the river today. I don't know what it is, but I can sort of hear it singing to me. In all those other years, it was just water flowing down the river to me. But it's a spiritual being now. It's got a new meaning, the awa. Seems every time I come to it, it has a different meaning.
I mean, just that experience and just sort of contemplating that, the experience of going onto the river, there's this sense very much that one is living, I guess maybe that one is living in subtext, and that the river itself is concealing and carrying so much information that there's a kind of transition in consciousness that you have to go through, I think, to really understand all the metaphors in the European sort of way of what the river represents. And you've talked about the mother, and we've talked about the whānau as a kind of unifying symbol as well.
I suppose I'm appropriating those in the sense that I've been taught by Tilly to revere it in those ways and to regard it in those ways, and to be again a further kaitiaki of voices wrought from the kohatū, the stone material, and in particular the pounamu, in the instruments that have been made from the stones that by and large, well, in fact almost exclusively she has found specifically for me. And of course she tells that wonderful story in the piece of looking for the stone and being confronted by a stone that she didn't recognise, hands on hips and speaking very sharply to it, but it was in fact a very beautiful piece of stone that metamorphosed into the two instruments that I had dreamed about. That's learning to perceive and live in those ways is a gift that my connection with Māori community and Arahura and Tilly particularly has enhanced hugely, and just to hear her speak also of growing up on the river, being bored by the river, being fed up with the river, going away from the river and then coming back to the river, and then in an extraordinary way naming me as an agent by which she reheard what the river had to say to her is quite extraordinary. And so it's nice to have a little sense that there's gifts going both ways.
While I've lived elsewhere for many years now, I'm 68, during this time there's been what is sometimes called a Maori renaissance, or there's been a resurgence of strength, cultural strength, and political strength developing in Maori communities all over the country. And a number of my friends are now bilingual, which I would love to be, and I'm not. And those are my friends who have both Maori and Pākehā ancestry, are focusing very strongly, like Gillian Whitehead, for example, an excellent composer, is focusing very strongly on her Maori inheritance. So I feel as if I missed something, a great richness, the opportunity to grow up in a country that was truly bicultural. So it was moving to me to be asked to make a piece in which we would incorporate the communication, you know, the experience of a Maori elder this way.
Seems an age since we were on the river, seems an age since we were recording, and it is. But I think most all of these things have a rightness of time for being brought forth, and maybe there's a reason that will become clear as to why it's taken somewhat longer than it seems to have necessarily.
We're working on geological time, I think,
Richard. Geological time, and traditional time. But it has been a wonderful, and continues to be a wonderful, connection between a significant New Zealand composer, myself, and a beautifully wrought piece of pounamu herself, which is Tilly, and her generosity of spirit and her openness. One can can only be really grateful for that kind of ongoing contact and the knowledge that she shared and the precious resource that she gives so freely that travels widely throughout the world. And all those people know the name Tilly Tainui and know the significance of the stone, and it's the most simple but most extraordinary thing to have this smooth, soothing piece of jade sitting in your pocket wherever you go, that connects you to an island nation at the bottom of the earth, really.
Imatua tupuna ki ora mor na panamu I ko hatu ki mata I tēnei rā ki tau ki tātou katoa te atapō o tō tātou ariki a ihu kurāti me te aroha o te atua me te pewhinga tahitanga ki te waru tapu ake ake āmini.